session number 30108, Reel 4.
John Glades, Reel 4. Can you tell me about what the course entailed then?
The Observer's course?
Yeah.
Okay. The first phase, actually, was learning about the engine, the Otto cycle, suck, squeeze, bang, blow. And I know nothing about engines. Totally, utterly boring to me. And then we did a bit of ground handling phase. This is how you refuel it. This is where you would plug in the batteries if you wanted to start it using a huge battery pack. And after those basic essential skills had been partially absorbed, we then moved on to the flying, map reading, navigation phases. So a huge amount of our time was spent planning sorties. We started off at a high level, 2,000 feet, navigation. Simple mathematics, really. You're going to travel at such and such a speed for so long to get to whatever. You want to go somewhere, the wind's blowing from at such and such a speed from whatever direction, aim off accordingly. And then as we got better at it, then we lost height and moved from navigation to map reading. And then it was very much nap of the earth flying, contour flying, and it was a huge transition from walking across the ground and patrolling at 2 or 3 miles an hour to travelling at 120 knots where the map is getting unfolded much more rapidly.
Is that quite a difficult transition to make initially?
Yeah. In some ways it's easier, having been an infantryman. But it's the speed at which you're moving over the ground that needs adjusting rather than a new set of map reading skills which has to be learned. My biggest difficulty was handling the aircraft itself, because we had to be able to land it. And taking the thing off and flying it wasn't really a problem. It's when you want to come back into contact with the earth that things tend to go awry.
So as an observer, you have to have these skills to do that?
Yes, dual control.
Is it just really if there's a problem with the pilot that you're able to land it, or you can...
Yes. And I mean, I knew occasions after that where a pilot had looked over his right shoulder and cricked his neck and couldn't face forward again and had to hand over to his air crewman, who took the aircraft back to camp and landed it for him. So real situations arose, but I think there was a situation where if a pilot did become incapacitated in a dual-control aircraft, you would be wise to have the person in the left-hand seat being able to at least put it down safely, if not recover it back to its base.
Flying a helicopter?
Yeah.
Can you give me some rough basic principles of what that really entails? What do you have to be able to do?
As far ahead as possible, while you're trying to get into the lowest hover, and then touchdown. Don't try and look too close to the aircraft, otherwise. Don't grip the controls too tightly, because the minutest movement can cause a reaction in the aircraft's attitude. So I would say, yeah, handle everything gently and don't try to look too closely, unless you're in a Norway situation where when you get recirculating snow, you have to focus on something down at the edge of a skid, almost, because you're in a whiteout condition.
And in flying it, does it involve hand and feet coordination?
Hand and feet, yeah. So you've got a cyclic control, which will affect the aircraft's motion, its nose up and down, tilt left or right. You've got a power lever. Of course, the more power you pull, the aircraft wants to twist in the opposite way to the rotor blades, so you have to feed in a counterbalancing effect using foot pedals. So yeah, it's difficult, to say the least.
I think I've heard it equated to rubbing your head and your stomach.
Yeah, say, yeah, yeah, like, I can't do that either.
I imagine that was quite an exciting thing to be involved in, though, wasn't it, at that time? Completely different from all the sort of...
Well, yeah. I mean, looking at all the different specialisations within the Royal Marines, it probably doesn't get any better. with the added bonus of Fly and Pay. I didn't even realise Fly and Pay existed. You know, I didn't go into it for the money. And then someone said, oh, you're going to get paid more for this. And I thought, wonderful.
How long did the training period take?
I think Observer's course was 12 weeks. There were other subjects within it. Of course, we used to do quite a lot of recognition, aircraft, armoured personnel carriers, and I think we had to get about a 90% pass mark on that. But when I went back on an air gunner's course, we had to get 95% because we were actually going to maybe take out these vehicles with SS-11 missiles, then they thought it more prudent that our level of recognition increased.
And I take it at that time it would have been a lot of the recognition skills would be needed not only for Allied vehicles but obviously for Russian vehicles, would it be?
Mostly Soviet, yeah, Warsaw Pact, because a lot of the Warsaw Pact countries' AFEs differed slightly from the Russians, so yeah, American, well, all the NATO countries as well. And that, as I say, fixed wing to a degree, but mostly tanks, APCs, etc.
And with that, would the helicopter operate in a manner when it was observing vehicles? Would you fly at very low level?
We had scale models which we would observe from a distance in a room. So you'd be actually looking at something in relative terms, say 2 kilometres away, albeit it was at the other end of the recognition room. And a lot of it was done with slide. You know, we didn't have the capacity to go out in the field, fly the helicopter and try and find a T-64 due to the shortage of T-64s, I guess, to plonk out in Salisbury Plain.
Was there any field training involved in that? Obviously, I know there was
not really. We did do a final exercise where it was cam and concealment of aircraft and a bit of low-level flying, and another aircraft would come along when we'd practice contact reports. But there was a para on my course as well, and we sort of treated the field exercise with a degree of disdain. You know, we've done all this, and we can live in the field, whereas for the Army Air Corps, air troopers and Lance Corporals, living in the field came as a little bit of a culture shock. You know, we didn't want to get the cape leather gloves too dirty.
Was that something that you would look at slightly differently with the sort of Army Air Corps?
I always thought of the Army Air Corps as a sort of mix between the Army and the RAF, so they took a huge amount of ribbing from the para and myself. But then we had other arms who were looking to transfer into the Army Air Corps, 1721st Lancer. We've had a guy from the Rimi. Because until the Army Air Corps started to take direct entrance, it had drawn from the other regiments of the British Army, and largely from the artillery and the armoured regiments, I believe.
Once the course finished, what was the next stage for you?
Oh, down into the squadron at Kaipu, bit of training, and then virtually straight to Northern Ireland with the Yet flight. And we were based at Ballykelly, which was Shackleton Barracks. Interesting, because a lot of wartime aircraft had flown from there. And if we were going up and down the coast, you could actually see the skeletons of these aircraft, which had run out of fuel and not quite made it back to Shackleton Barracks. But we were tasked by 8th Brigade, I think it was 8th Brigade, based in Londonderry. And our patch mainly was inside the Sparring Bowl, which was at Limavady, Coleraine, and Londonderry itself.
So not much call for anti-tank work there?
No, well, I was in Gazelles at this stage, and we had 3 Gazelles. We had one on 5 minutes notice. We had another one at reduced notice as a backup, and then one was dedicated to another group of people who lived in Ballykelly camp as well.
So what would your main duties be with the air? What would you be doing in the Gazelles?
A lot of liaison work. Oh, we did night sun as well. So daytime, tasking could be anything from picking up the brigadier and taking him to a meeting. If there was a shooting in Londonderry, we'd get aloft fairly quickly. And especially if car description came over, you know, a red Ford Transit or something, then we'd be flying the routes to try and pick it up. But, you know, Londonderry is so close to the border. Their direct route to safety was minutes away. But, you know, there were shootings in the city, and we had to deploy fairly sharpish. But then at night, if the police had an operation and they'd want an area illuminated, then we'd take the night sun up and assist them like that. We'd always do a perimeter check of the camp at night.
Threats? Were there any? What were the main threats to you from them? Would there be a threat from
small arms fire? Well, we always flew at 2,000 feet because that was deemed to be above the level of, you know, of small arms, even M60s. Because if you fire, and we used to practice firing from a helicopter with tracer, and the round just curves off behind you, so we were rather hoping that anything coming our way was equally affected by the rotors.
Would there be a threat, though, maybe coming into land? Would that be
no, we were actually in the field, maybe, but most of the a huge number of landing sites all over the place. There's more of a threat of bumping into someone else. So there was always a blind call if you were lifting out of White 701 or whatever, so that an aircraft coming into that area knew that there was a Gazelle going to pop up. A lot of low pylons around. Especially in Londonderry, over the river. But going into camps, generally, there was crinkly tin up to 20 feet or more, and you got down behind that fairly quickly.
Because I know, obviously, the IRA were quite keen during that period to shoot down a helicopter. Would you be aware that there was a threat?
Absolutely, yeah. But you can't live your life thinking that you've got it shot down. I mean, I think in the Beaver flight down in Aldergrove, a round came up through the floor and actually severed the Mike tail lead of the observer, who then obviously couldn't communicate with the pilot. So, yeah, I mean, we were aware of it because it was happening. But sitting in a helicopter, you're cocooned. You feel you're safe, the same as a young kid in a sports car. It's never going to happen to him. He's never going to crash that sports car.
Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of the Gazelle as a helicopter?
Light and fragile, but fast and manoeuvrable. I enjoyed my time in Gazelles, but it didn't have the robustness of a Scout. You know, Rolls Royce engine on there and lots of pop rivets and tried and tested. The Gazelle was a sports car. Typically French, the chaps used to say.
With your posting, how long was your posting for? Would it have a duration, or were you with the squadron for as long as you
wanted? Open-ended, basically. And probably the amount of money spent on training us, we could be there. Not indefinitely, because there was a policy to rotate people back on ground to us. But, you know, I wasn't there thinking, this is all going to end in 2 years. This was a qualification that I brought it. A specialist qualification, an area that I'd gone into, and I could see me doing that for the rest of my career, punctuated with ground tours.
So you could then return back?
Absolutely, yeah.
All the time?
Yeah.
Relations with your pilot, would it be the same pilot? Would you have different pilots?
No, never. And I say that with the added caveat that B Flight didn't operate like that in the Falklands. But mostly you would fly with a different pilot, and a pilot would fly with a different aircraft. You'd never have the same aircraft. And the reasoning behind that was that if an aircraft was developing a fault slowly over time, a pilot wouldn't recognise that day to day. But a fresh pilot coming in would say, oh, different sound here, different vibration, different feel. And I think changing crews, a similar philosophy, you never took each other for granted. By having a new pilot, the observer always felt, oh, I've got so-and-so today, what can I best do to please him, to develop teamwork, so he thinks I'm totally and utterly professional. And I would like to think that the pilot was thinking that about the talking ballast observer sat next to him. Because I knew observers who could fly as well as pilots. In there, they just had this aptitude for it. Their problem was that they couldn't pass the command courses. And if only they'd have been able to pass a junior command course, senior command course, then they'd have made very good pilots.
At that stage, were there any NCO pilots, or were they all officer pilots?
Oh, no, a mix. It was a mix of NCO and officer. And, you know, some of the pilots were acting sergeant. And some years later, I think the Army Air Corps had corporal pilots. And they had equal status, I think, the senior NCO and the officer pilots. Whether either of those groups felt themselves to be at a higher level in the pecking order, I don't know, but to the air crew, we knew who the good ones were, and those who, they passed their course, can't fault it, but we knew who, I mean, I said to a friend of mine the other day, the best pilot I ever flew with, he stopped me straight away and gave a name, and it was the name that I was about to say. So if there was a pecking order, the air crew established it. The observers and the air gunners established the true pecking order, I think, because we were more objective about it.
Could you take me through sort of a routine operation, maybe somewhere in the countryside that you'd be involved in, and from sort of a briefing period right the way through to how it would happen? Is that possible?
Yeah. Well, the aircrew day always started with the Met anyway. And if we say, not in Northern Ireland, but the day began with the weather, what the weather was going to do, whether there were any NOTAMs, notice to airmen, pertinent to the local area, like were there some hang gliders going off a certain cliff, with the balloonists in the area, and then there would always be a recognition phase, and that would be run by the observers and air gunners, so the pilots would have to sit there and be taught something by us for 15 minutes, and we loved that. Then, if there was a job on, yeah, you get the maps out, draw the line, where you go from A to B, and then of course you'd have to look a bit further afield, and were there any NOTAMs pertinent to, because of course we're covering from, I don't know, you could go from Plymouth to Manchester and back in the day, so you'd have to be aware of anything up there en route, any particular hazards. If we were low level, of course you'd have to know where there were stud farms, chicken farms, you know, huge no-go areas where helicopters had to stay out of the way because it could destroy someone's business. You fly over, you know, 40,000 chickens all in their coops, low level, and of course there's potential for disaster and a few phone calls into the squadron commander.
Would that still be the case in Northern Ireland? Did you have the same kind of restrictions there?
Well, because we generally stayed at 2,000 feet from A to B, we went up there and down. Different down on the border, of course, where we were bobbing and weaving anyway. And I look on it now from a different perspective, where being a patrol commander, wanting to, an aircraft to come up and come in and pick my patrol up quickly at an LS, which I chose, and then this RAF guy is saying, oh, can you pick a different one next time? Because we almost stampeded the cattle. And I'd say, bollocks to the cattle, I want to get out of here fast, you know. So, as a troop on the ground, you look at it differently to an aviator, perhaps. And that, I guess, is the beauty of Royal Marines Aviation, and all these guys being on the ground and have an understanding of the difficulties of getting from A to B. Because if you make a mistake in a Gazelle and you're 2 miles off course, it's going to take you a minute to get back on it. When you're carrying a Bergen over difficult terrain and you're 2 miles off course, it's going to take you 2 hours to get back to it. You know.
So, in Northern Ireland, would you be allocated a job for the day? Would you know what that would be? Or would
Well, you could be on 5 minute standby, and a lot of that could be just sitting in the crew room waiting for the klaxon to go. If you were on 5 minute standby, you could be, you'd certainly do a day on the radio in the ops room, and, because an aircraft would leave and there would be overdue procedures. And if a guy was going down to the border, say it's down across McGlen, you'd expect him to be across McGlen at a certain time. His duty was to ring you back and say, I'm in Cross McGlen safely. So there was an important ground role for the aircrew to perform as well. And you'd probably do, we had three aircraft, I think we had like a day on standby, day on the optional, day off, something like that. But they'd be 24-hour shifts and 24 off.
And was there a problem with the border being so close, that you could stray over into, other, by accident, stray over?
Well, near Londonderry, we use a 1 over 25,000 map, and the border is fairly precise by hedgerow, by ditch, by gully. And from up at 2,000 feet, you can afford to have a margin of, not a margin of error, you could afford to be quarter of a mile inside the border without it being detrimental to what you're trying to look at. So, I mean, yeah, straying over the border was not a problem, but people were aware that it was would cause a diplomatic incident. You'd be in someone else's airspace. But it was easily resolved. You just had to pay attention. And often, of course, at that height, the reason you were on the border, you'd be in a high hover anyway. You know, you were able to gauge it and adjust slightly as wind would drift you over in a particular direction.
Would it be very difficult, I suppose, on somebody on the ground to actually gauge where you were in their space?
Well, at 2,000 feet, many people on the ground would be unaware of your presence anyway. And often, if we were coming low over the sparings, we were travelling at such speed that we were almost on top of people in fields before they looked up, and then we were gone. Because we were there almost as quick as the sound of our engines got there. Almost, you know.
And what equipment did you have in those days? Because obviously you're aware these days of infrared cameras and that sort of thing on helicopters. But what were you equipped with?
Night sun. That was it. I mean, we carried small arms, pistols. For a while we carried SLRs with a bullet catcher on it, so the round, the case was caught in this great canvas tube, so it wasn't, you know, flying around in the airframe had we needed to use it. All tracer. I can't recall anybody ever having to use it, and it may be that we later didn't even bother carrying it. You know, the chances of hitting something from up there were fairly remote.
Was there a reason why they'd issued you with it at all? Was there anything they were suspected that you might need it for?
Well, yeah, airborne snipers, of course, are in vogue today and have been used out in the Caribbean, being recently to shoot out the engines of boats carrying drugs up through the Caribbean. So I guess it was perceived that an occasion would arise where you could put down some form of suppressive fire from the aircraft. As I say, I can't recall it being used. But
are there any incidents that stand out from that period that occurred while you were flying?
A fairly intense day when a plainclothes guy was killed sitting in his car in Londonderry, and one of our aircraft was actually above Londonderry and virtually saw the event and certainly heard it on the radio, and we spent all day searching. If I recall, it was a yellow Mazda pickup truck or something, which was probably long undercover. Then, you know, driven into some garage or yard or something. That was fairly tragic, you know.
And you would spend the whole day just trying to ascertain the whereabouts of that vehicle?
Until we were told to stand down. The decision was taken, you know, that wasn't our decision to make. Eventually someone in the Ops Room or 8th Brigade, I suppose, would say, okay, we'll have to pull stumps on this one now.
Was it an unsuccessful search for it? Had it gone to ground?
Oh, yes, yeah.
With an intense day like that, what was the kind of, how long were you in the air?
7 hours, something like that, I guess. I mean, there were limits, pilot limits, on a month. And if I cannot remember what that limit was, but if a guy reached his limit, then he could apply to the qualified helicopter instructor, QHI, down in Aldergrove to have an extension of 10 hours. If he infringed that, then they'd have to think about him maybe coming off flying duties or maybe getting a replacement guy in. So it's very strict on how long a person could fly so that there wasn't a build-up of fatigue.
How were you taken to the work? Was it something that you...
Relished it, loved it. I mean, it was just... And the first year, there was an army battalion in Ballykelly, 78. When I went back in 79, 40 Commander was on a year's tour in Ballykelly. So we were living in a barracks run by Marines. The unfortunate part, perhaps, was that because we were still called Diet Flight, 40 Commando thought the three aircraft belonged to them, whereas they actually belonged to 8 Brigade. And there was a bit of confusion, I suppose, between their ops officer and our side for a while. I doubt if it lasted very long. A phone call from 8 Brigade would have cleared the air, no doubt.
Did you have a certain amount within your role? Did you feel a certain amount of individuality, I suppose, is the word, really? That
well, there were so few of us in the Corps, you see. When I became an air gunner, I think there were 6 or 7 of us in the Corps. A few more observers, but, of course, we all thought we were bloody special, didn't we? And
when did you become an air gunner?
I probably did 18 months in Gazelles. But I also did my sergeant's course in that time. So by the time I went on my air gunner's course, I was a sergeant. And that was 4 weeks. Must have been about 79. It was 1979.
What was the reason for the change? Did you want to do that, or was it something that had been introduced?
Well, you had to be, in those days, you had to do the observer's course to be an air gunner. And the air gunner's course was merely 4 weeks on the end of an observer's course. So it was possible to become an air gunner from being a rifleman. You would just do the observer's course and the air gunner's course back to back. But we felt as air gunners that we'd been chosen for that because we were the best observers. Rightly or wrongly.
And why was that? Was that because of your ability to pinpoint things on the ground?
Overall ability. It wasn't a physical thing like that. It's your overall airmanship and experience, I suppose. And because the scout is a little bit more difficult to handle than a gazelle in landing, you know, a little bit more precarious, less aerodynamic. So there's that side to it. But there was a general perception that air gunner was an upward step from being an observer.
What did that course involve when you were doing the air gunner's course?
That involved a lot of time sitting in a darkened room, steering a dot along the far wall, just to build up your level of eye-hand coordination. And the dot would last about 45 seconds, and you had to steer it around a sort of clock face and get to the number 9 position before the dot zapped out. Because 45 seconds was about the missile flight time. At 3,000 metres, should we say. Lot of time stuck in the darkened room. And you could only do it for, say, 20 minutes, and then you go out and have a long break back in another 20 minutes. And because there was two machines and about 8 of us on course, that was a problem. Still more flying, and we did a little bit more on judging distance because the sight... had 2 magnifications, and you needed to be able to look at an object using these magnifications, although there were graticules in there to assist you, and decide whether it was 1K or 2.5K away.
Was that an interesting development then with the air gunners course? Did you enjoy that side of things? Was that more...
Yeah, a little bit more hands-on, if you like. Certainly a little bit more responsibility. We saw the pilot's job was to get us into a position in a low hover, unobserved. Then it was our job to say, to you know, get put our hand or select a missile. The missiles were ready to go. Get the rotary firing switch in your hand, finger on the joystick, and say to the pilot, firing missile now. You'd raise the rotary firing switch, it would run its course along this slope, and then the missile would ignite, it would pause, leave the rails with a terrific whoosh and a mind of its own, hopefully appear in the site, and then this bucking Bronco, subject to the vagaries of wind patterns shooting down gullies, would be off. And the wires would be snaking out behind it, and you'd be trying to send impulses down the wires to control it. The longer the wire became, the bigger the time lag of the impulse that you were transmitting to the missile. And you tried never to allow the missile to fall below the target, or it would probably hit the deck. Sweat. And if they could record the pilot when it... I remember a pilot